Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Joel Whitaker, editor of Kane's Beverage News Daily, and today we are interviewing Christina Mariani May. Christina is a third generation in the family that owns the Banfi Estates, Banfi Vineyards, and that entire empire. And today we're going to talk about the change in the business and what she and her cousin James have been doing. And so, Christina, it's nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Joel.
And let's just start out very nice and easily. Tell us a little bit about the background of the family business, maybe going back to, I guess, your grandfather starting it, and then your father and his brother, and sort of, you know, in about 3 or 4 minutes, bring us up to speed on that. And then we'll talk about things that have been happening more recently, including the purchase of a winery in Washington State, the acquisition by your dad, I guess, of Banfi, Castello Banfi out in Italy, and all of that, and the role that you all are playing. And then the role of, I'd like to also work into here the role of women in the business, because that certainly is a changing environment. I recall when I first started covering alcoholic beverages 25 years ago or so, that it was very much a man's world, and I don't think that's necessarily totally true anymore. So with that sort of introduction, let me just let you start talking, and I will shut up, and, you know, I'll pop in with questions as we need to.
Great. Great. Well, to go back to three generations ago, when my grandfather started our family firm, which is called Banfi, which is obviously different from my last name, which is Mariani, but he was inspired to start a wine importing business down in Greenwich Village, New York, back in 1919, and he was inspired by his aunt, Teodolinda Banfi. And Teodolinda has this amazing story because actually in the early 1900s, she was the first woman ever to be permitted to live within the Vatican walls. I should say she was the first non-clergy. And as such, she was in charge of running the entire household for Pope Pius XI. And she was in charge of selecting his wine, to, you know, obviously running his entire house staff. And she had an amazing palate, knew all about the great wines of Europe. And as a young boy, her nephew, who was my grandfather, was sent from America, where he was born from Italian parents. But he was sent from America back to Italy to be raised by his aunt, Teodolinda Banfi. So she raised him for his entire young life and taught him all about great wine, great food, the culture of Italy, and the table. And he came back to America as a young lad, and he started a wine importing house, and he ended up naming it after the aunt who was like his mother. So the firm today is called Banfi, after her honor. And she was also equivalent also to the confidant or the adopted sister of Pope Pius XI. And when she passed away, she was the first woman ever to be honored to be buried within the Vatican walls. So she goes down in history as this amazing woman. So when we, you know, you ask a question about women in the wine business, well, they do go quite far back. They just didn't always have the recognition. Very often they were behind the scenes and not in front of the house. But today, you know, four generations later, there's a woman back running the business with myself. So it kind of comes around full circle, I suppose. But my grandfather started the business, and it was tiny, and, you know, it started, and as soon as he opened his doors, Prohibition came. So it wasn't exactly the best timing to be in the wine importing business, but they ended up bringing in, like, a lot of products from Italy, such as the sea salts, the Montecatini spa salts. They ended up making the Amaro bitters in their garage, and they sold them in the pharmacies as mild laxatives. And you can imagine that when you were permitted with a bit of alcohol that you have from the Amaro bitters, as when they sold them as digestifs or digestives, the things flew off the shelves during Prohibition. So they were able to succeed through that trying time for us in the wine business. But it was really when my dad, who today is chairman emeritus, and his younger brother, Harry, came in and they started importing really some of the great wines of the world.
Yeah,
go ahead.
When was that?
Well, that was in the 1950s, really. So they acted as a negociant. They brought in a lot of the first growths under the Banffy label. They were bringing in a lot of Italian wines, but Italian wines aren't nearly, were not of the level of the great Rhine Valley, the great Mosels, the Burgundy, the Bordeaux, as they were 1950s, 1960s. So they were bringing in a lot of wines and products from Italy, but it was really the French wines that were their popular sellers. But that all changed when my father started having a vision on how to get more Americans consuming wines in the 1960s, and he said they're not going to do it drinking the more the drier wines and the great first growths of Italy, I mean of France and of Europe, but let's find a wine that's more amabile, a little bit softer in style, one that can be served in more informal settings, and one that can introduce people to pure and natural wines, but make it an everyday concept, as if, you know, in Europe there's always a bottle of wine on the table. So it was with that that they started bringing in the Lambrusco. And it was during the 60s and 70s and at the height in the 80s that they brought it under the name Riuniti and did some savvy marketing. And it ended up selling more wine than any imported wine in the history of the U.S. And it was a phenomenal success for the family. And really with that success, they were able to take that and say, let's now go deeper into Italy to create a wine estate. And so the goal had always been to help elevate the standards of all Italian winemaking. But in the 70s, this is before there was a real renaissance in fine winemaking in Italy. So we probably could have easily have gone in and purchased up an existing estate and made an acquisition. But really it wasn't an acquisition, because when my father had gone back to Italy, what he realized was it was so deeply rooted in tradition of how previous generations made wine that it was kind of difficult to forget the mistakes of the past and to innovate for the future when you have such deep-seated tradition. So he paired up with a gentleman and a younger gentleman who became our winemaker, and he said, let's do it from scratch. So they bought mostly virgin soil. They ended up acquiring about 7,000 acres in the southern Tuscany in the region of Montalcino, and it was there that they started experimenting predominantly with the Sangiovese grape for the Brunello di Montalcino, and also with many grapes that hadn't existed in Tuscany, such as Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Syrah, Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Grigio, and numerous noble varieties. And that was the inception in 1978 of Castello Banffi. And today we've been there 32 years, and Castello Banffi has become known around the world now for what it's done for a renaissance of Brunello di Montalcino, and also for helping pioneer a lot of the super Tuscans. So that's kind of where our family is today. We still are importers in the U.S. with our importing business. We're one of the leading importers of wines in the U.S., but our heart and our soul is also based in the hills of Tuscany.
And you are responsible for the Tuscany operations, yes, no?
Directly responsible, yes. We have a general manager, of course, and an Italian team that runs it for us. But I have a cousin, James Mariani, who I work very closely with, who's my co-CEO. And our indirect roles are that I work very closely with the Italian production from Castello Banffi and all the 90 markets we sell around the world. And James focuses a lot on our imported brands and our U.S. domestic market for our sales and distribution.
Now, on Monday, you all are going to be doing a bell ring, I believe, at NASDAQ to mark the end of the trading day for NASDAQ. Tell us a little bit about this involvement and why you're doing this and that sort of thing, because Banffy is not a public company.
That's true. And hopefully we will remain as a private family operation. That's something that we find very unique and special about us. However, through the Vinitaly organization, Vinitaly is one of the largest wine fairs that exists in Verona, Italy, every year. Through that, there's a wonderful woman who's assistant to the chairman, whose name is Stevie Kim. And it was Stevie's idea to recognize the women in Italian wine. And they had an opportunity through the Vinitaly Fair to ring the closing bell to recognize what the wines of Italy do for the commerce and the trade of the country, and particularly here in the U.S., the strong affiliation and trade relations we have with Italy. But she wanted a female winemaker to be able to recognize also how far Italy has come as far as generations of now women running a lot of businesses. So she wanted to show kind of the evolution of Italian wines. So I was honored to be able to be asked, along with Marilisa Allegrini from the Allegrini Wines up in Verona, predominantly, and to join them in ringing the closing bell of NASDAQ. So it was a great honor. So I'm thrilled. I mean, wonderful opportunity. So
it sounds like just an awful lot of fun, and a great honor, as you say, and something truly unique. I don't know if we've ever had, somebody from the beverage alcohol business, wine, beer, probably beer, I would guess, Anheuser-Busch. But, you know, at least from the wine side, actually ring the bell at any of the exchanges. So that's a very, very unique thing.
It is. It's such an honor. We represent in our U.S. operations Conchitoro, as you know, which is traded on the New York Stock Exchange. So I would have thought perhaps that would be a logical guess to ring a bell on one of the exchanges, but this is just a wonderful opportunity that they're trying to do for all Italian wines. So I was just honored that I was able to be present at the ceremonies.
Now, I would suspect that you all are the largest importer of Italian wine.
We are the, you know, I'm going to say yes, Joel, but I know that Palm Bay imports a lot now with Cabot. We do import, though, we do have the number one selling red Italian wine, which is the Riuniti Lambrusco. So I believe, yes, we are the largest importer of Italian wines, but, you know, I haven't looked at the figures recently. So we might be neck and neck with our friends who sell Cabot.
Well, that would not necessarily be a bad thing. Well, it would be a bad thing from your standpoint, perhaps, because good business people always want to be number one, but certainly wouldn't be a bad thing to have two strong importers of Italian wines very busily promoting the country and the product.
Exactly. We just want Italian wines to sell in general with Banffy. And you know, the more people who produce good Italian wine and go out and sell it to consumers and turn them on to the beauties of the wines that come from this country, the better it is for us. So it's a very friendly competition.
And that's a very good thing. So what I would like to do at this point is sort of explore a little bit about your product line itself. I mean, we know about the Riuniti Lambrusco line, but you indicated that you had a broader portfolio than that. So sort of tell us where the family business is today. We know where it started, and we know how you got through the Great Depression and how you got into the farming business, which, you know, some people would not have the courage to do. But where is the business today? Where do you see it, and where do you think it's going to go?
Well, our business is growing, and I think one of the strengths, or two of the strengths that we have, is one is that we represent a range of beautiful wines from several different price points. There's many importers that might specialize either in volume wines or in high-end fine wines at higher price points. And we've always been very fortunate in Banffy Vintners to be able to sell a range of wines that appeal to consumers at different price levels. So whether Italian wines are doing well or South American or Australian, that we have various opportunities. Another strength that we see for our my generation of James and myself, is that we are privately held, that it is in control of a family. And with that comes a culture and a decision-making, a rapidness that we have over some of our larger competitors. Because we're not a small company, but we're not one of the giants. And some of the bigger companies, you know, they're now publicly traded. They carry a lot of debt. They have to answer to a lot of shareholders, and that burdens them. In the wine business, as we know, it's very long-term. Things do not happen overnight, and you have to really have a lot of patience. And a lot of that comes from a family background, a long-term commitment to capital investment, long-term return on your assets. If you have that wherewithal to withstand that and to continue to grow and to grow to be a strong, healthy size, then I think it really becomes quite an advantage in the wine business globally. And so we're very fortunate that it's not just in the U.S., but as a global player, we're able to maintain that culture of family traditions, family values, and a culture of a team of players around the globe that really believe heart and soul in what our company is and believe in dedicating their lives. We're very passionate about the company. It's like our child. And I think that's something that sets us apart in these more difficult sales times. So.
And are you all dealing with a wine glut at the moment? I mean, I know that they're swimming in wine down in Australia. I believe they're pulling vineyards out of the ground now. And I heard the same thing is now happening in New Zealand. So is that impacting you, or are you able to sort of go through that?
No, that isn't impacting us directly, because in Italy, yes, there's a lot of wine, but it really helps us sometimes because it brings down some prices on bulk wine. In South America, there is not a shortage. There's less of a glut. So that has not impacted us directly, no. But how it's impacting us is on the shelves when we look at our competition. And in some categories, the prices are really coming down quite rapidly. So we have to be smart and wise with how we position our products on the shelves in order to you know, not be lost out to the competition, that some are really from different categories with such a glut of wine really coming in at very low prices. So.
And how are you dealing with that issue? I mean, you have to be smart. How are you being smart, if I can ask?
Well, you know, I think we really have to judge it, Joel, based upon which is the positioning of each product. And we're fortunate that we have products we can fight like heck with price. You know, more everyday wines. And so we go out there and we compete like the best of them. And we're very fortunate that as a company, we represent some suppliers that have a lot of strength within their category. So from South America, we have Conchi Toro. From Italy, aside from representing our own wines, we also represent a lot of wines from the cooperative Civ Riuniti / which is now part of Gruppo Italiani Vini. So we have wonderful suppliers that have great influence within their market. So they're able to bring us the best juice at the best prices. So in that sense, we're positioned properly. So that's, you know, but we have to make the call with our team in each market with each product. But at least we have a great diversity and range of products to be able to sell and compete with.
Good. Now, one of the things that makes you somewhat different than some of your competitors, I know, is that you have your growers and vintners as well as importers. And I wonder, do you think that provides you with any competitive advantages, or do you think it's one of those nice things, but it doesn't make a difference one way or the other in terms of how you compete against some of the larger companies or some of the smaller companies?
No, well, definitely I see it as an advantage because we understand the entire chain, production chain and distribution chain. In the United States, it works greatly to our advantage because now what we're seeing is a lot of buyers they don't want to have to go through middlemen always. So we, when it comes to Italy, we can directly affect the source, and they know that as owners, we're able to make the decisions from the vineyard all the way through to the shelf. So that is really a unique advantage to us. Whereas a lot of our Italian competitors here in the U.S. just act as importers. So when customers are working directly with them, they are basically just acting as more of a middleman. So it is to our advantage that we're able to service our customers in such a way that we can make sure the entire process and system is very fluid. So that works to our advantage. Sure, it's hard to be a grower. You know, it's easier to be a merchant and an importer and a marketer. There's less risk. There's less capital invested. It's a beautiful business being an importer because, you know, we can really do the fun job of marketing and selling. We don't have to worry about Mother Nature as much. Growing the grapes from the soil, learning about the techniques, what's happening around the world, it keeps us connected to what our roots are. And being that we're also producers helps us with our other suppliers that we represent because they know we understand what it takes and what it's like and the challenges of growing grapes from the very beginning. So,
you know, you've made two points that remind me of comments I've heard from some public companies. One of them is Brown-Forman, which, while it's a public company, is really very tightly controlled to this day by the Brown family, and they show no indications they intend to have that change if they can possibly avoid it. I mean, they actually have two investor relations guys, one for the public and one for the family, which is really quite something. But they make the point repeatedly that they think that fact enables them to be able to do many of the things you're talking about, take a long-term view, not having to be driven by short-term things on Wall Street or whatever. And then the people at Anheuser-Busch a few years ago were talking about the fact that they owned a couple of wholesale operations, like out of Newark, New Jersey, for instance. And they made the same point that it enabled them to understand what their distributors were dealing with. It enabled them to be closer to the market and not to just be sitting up here on the mountaintop as the supplier while the distributor is down there saying, what are these people thinking? That they actually had a better understanding of the market as a result of that. And I sort of wonder why it is that more companies aren't more integrated, if you will.
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think from just knowing those other companies that you reference, in our industry, and Joel, you could probably attest to this too, but it pays to focus. That when we used to be in the distribution business, and we got out because we decided we needed to focus our energies, and were we going to invest our resources in acquiring big brands, spirits brands, in order to succeed in the New York distribution market, or would we rather use those resources and invest in what we already had, which was winemaking and wine importing? We decided that it was best to concentrate and do what we do best. And even interesting that you should mention, I'm getting a little feedback there. It's interesting that you should mention Brown-Forman because we ended up acquiring from Brown-Forman two of their very classic historic brands, which are Bola and Fontana Candida from Frascati. And with Gruppo Italiani Vini Riuniti Civ, which is one company now, we ended up purchasing the label with them for the United States from Brown-Forman. And what we saw even with Brown-Forman is they were divesting more of the wine business so that they could focus on the spirit business. So I think this is just now from my perspective, but when you have a family business and you want to do something the best, you want to be number one in your category. And to be number one in your category, whatever that category might be, takes a lot of energy and resources and focus. And the way you can compete in that is to kind of not spread yourself too thin, but to really pick one channel and do it the best possibly you can. And that's what we've decided to do.
Well, good. That's obviously been a smart decision for you all. And I do recall when Brown-Forman divested Bull, I sat there and I said, this is interesting. And because they'd done so well with that for a number of years. And then obviously they came to a point they decided to focus, I guess, more on the spirit side. And, you know, that's fine. Everybody makes their own decisions. And I certainly understand why you would perhaps not want to be in the distribution side, because that really is not only... Excuse me. Not only do you have to deal with the issue of, negotiating with other suppliers, but you also are in a business that really is one of nickels and dimes at the most. Is a lot of work for a very small margin. You know, enough volume, you obviously make a lot of money, but still a lot of work for a small margin. I'd like to ask you, if I could, about advertising, because I used to see a lot of ads for Reuniti on TV, and I don't think I've seen ads for any of your products on TV lately. How are you doing your marketing, and why, and do you plan on keeping whatever you're doing now, or are you going to change the mix, or what?
Well, we are always trying to reach out to the consumer, but we've been doing it more so in recent years by going through the trade channel specifically in each marketplace and not going out through greater consumer advertising. Consumer advertising, we did a lot of it in the 80s with Reuniti, and you did see a lot, but back then the buying was a lot simpler because there were about three network channels. Mm-hmm. And we had ads on the Super Bowl, and you saw our ads. I mean, our Reuniti on Ice, That's Nice, was everywhere. But that started getting harder and more expensive to try to really focus a listener's or a viewer's attention onto certain ads at times when we just came across so many different venues in order to advertise. So we decided to pull back from that more. We still invest in a lot of markets in radio for our different products, and of course print advertising, but we've done cable buys over the years in more targeted markets, because now what we know is we really have the strong data to show the demographics of where to buy the advertising and when, and we do that. It's just not a national buy anymore. So you might not see the advertising all over, but in local markets, it is taking place. But a lot of times it's more radio, internet, some cable, but not national on the networks. So that's just a decision we made because it started getting very expensive to buy national advertising. And we decided to go more to more of a trade advertising, so more with the point of sale and local promotions and sweepstakes, and also with local radio and some local cable.
And that's obviously working well for you.
It is. I mean, we always evaluate what we can do. There's more spends always to make. The Italian government has been great, and they have this program called OCM where they're sponsoring or helping Italian companies with their advertising and promotional expenses. So you're starting to see now a lot more advertisements come out with the European community symbol and the Italian flag on it. And with that, we're able to invest even further in building recognition for all brands that are Italian and get it out there in front of the consumer more and more to show really the value that Italian wines can bring to your table. So,
terrific. And looking ahead, do you have I'm going to ask this in a very stupid way.
Yeah.
Which is, are you satisfied with the share you have in the market now, or are you looking to expand that share, or, how competitive are you?
Well, we're really looking now to expand that share. We always have, to be honest, but, we'll grow in certain categories, and other categories might retract that we're in. But as what we're excited about is that we have a new generation at the helm. We're in our prime. We have big thoughts on how to strategize to take our company ahead. But we also want to have organic growth, partly, and we're very conservative. We're not a family who goes out there and makes a ton of acquisitions. We act very carefully. We want to make sure that when we make a move, it's to be number one in a category. So, for example, we made this acquisition recently of the Pacific Rim wines from Washington State, and they are really one of the leading specialists in Rieslings. And we saw an opportunity with Riesling in the U.S. and around the world for great consumer appeal and for great growth. And the Pacific Rim wines were just positioned so perfectly for growth opportunity. And we said, that's where we want to be. They're going to be number one in their category. They're right behind Chateau Saint-Michel right now, but the potential is tremendous. And we said, that's when we're going to jump. That's when we're going to make a move domestically. And we haven't made a move domestically as a family in generations. So this is when we're ready to go. So this is how we see our growth. It is very, as I said, it's conservative. But when we do it, we're guaranteed a higher return on the investment because we want to be number one in whatever category we're playing in.
And that makes good sense. Now, is Pacific Rim the only vineyard?
Domestic?
Domestic?
Yes, it's the only domestic one. So, and then the other vineyards, of course, are in Montalcino with our, in the territory, you know, for the Brunello. And there again, as a family, we've become number one in a category. And the wines of Brunello really have risen to the top of being really the center of fine red wines in all of Italy. And Castello Bambi crowns kind of that territory. And then we also have some vineyards up in Piedmont where we produce sparkling wines. We produce a Brachetto d'Acqui called Rosa Regale, which is a fast-growing product for us, a red sparkling dessert wine, and Rosa Regale is magnificent. So we produce some sparkling wines up in Piedmont, and that's it for the family as far as vineyards. Again, conservative because there are a lot to manage, but when we do it, we become number one. So,
And I would gather, knowing the size of operation that you often are involved in, that we should not expect Pacific Wine to remain the size it is, Pacific Rim, I'm sorry, to remain the size it is today, but we should expect it to grow both because of your desire for it to be the number one in its category, and number two, just because you all tend to go for big operations, or at least that's fine.
Well, actually, no, Pacific Rim's not a huge operation, and we have an interesting strategy with this one, is that we're maintaining the separate sales division. This was an acquisition by the family, not to blend in the culture and the wines and the sales structure into the Banffy Vintners portfolio. And as a family, we've decided to keep it separate because it's able to retain its uniqueness and its agility to move in the marketplace, and it has great success right now. And with their team in place, and we didn't want to disturb that. So they are not huge. I mean, I think they're about 160,000 cases. They're not tiny, but we are not a company who comes in and gobbles up other brands and brings them into our fold and just blows them out in size. We do it carefully. We do it properly. We place them properly, and we build brands. And it's not a commodity. We're not dumping Riesling out there or dumping Brunellos or, you know, whether it's wines from South America, but we carefully position them so that we are still going to be a major player 10 years from now, 15 years from now. So that's kind of the strategy we take. It takes a little more patience and takes understanding, but we like to maintain the uniqueness of each brand.
Should we assume that Pacific Rim will acquire some additional land out there and you will expand the production capability?
Well, we ended up,
you know, down the road.
Down the road, sure. I mean, there's opportunity for growth, absolutely, because if we go according to plan and what the strategy is, we will continue to grow with it. And then let's not be foolish here. We are business people, and we want to grow and continue to have profitable brands as well. So, yes, the idea is to keep growing, not to maintain just a small boutique operation, but to get the brand out in front of the consumers, absolutely.
Terrific. And a couple of final questions, I guess. And these are, you know, how you've got the operation set up. And if I get too personal, please you know, beg off and tell me so. But I'm curious as to how you all, I'm assuming you have buy-sell agreements in place to ensure that the business remains within the family. And
absolutely. I mean, family estate planning is so important. So we structured that all several years ago.
And I presume you look at it periodically, probably all.
Oh, yes, of course. We have advisors who help us, and we've got everything estate planning-wise lined up because we don't want to have any succession issues. That's a big point with a lot of 1As that you see. You know, one generation planned for a business, and the next generation might want to get out. So we've secured ourselves, so there's no issues in that arena.
Oh, that's terrific. And you know, I've talked to several people who've been in other situations, so I'm glad to hear that that's where you're set up, so you'll be able to keep going for hopefully generations to come.
Generation to generation, yes. You need smart people to help you plan that out, but we got the good advisors.
Good. Now, is there anything that we have not talked about that you wish we had?
I don't think so, Joel, because I think I covered most of the points. I mean, I think just what I'd love your readers to know is just, you know, that, you know, Banffy, we're a dynamic company. We're excited about the future. You know, we're proud of the awards we've gotten over the years, Joel, that, you know, we've came in as Americans into Italy, and we've gotten awards from the Association of Italian Sommeliers as being doing the most for all of Italian wines out of any producer. And Vinitaly has recognized us consistently for being one of the leading producers out of Italy. You know, we're proud. We've been recognized, Joel, as the first winery in the world to receive triple ISO certification for exceptional environmental, ethical, and social responsibility. And for us, that's something we're very proud of because we've always believed, whether it's from our own winery, whether it's Banffy, Pacific Rim, the wines we represent from Riuniti and Bolla Fontana or Conchi Toro, that we want pure, natural wines that consumers will love and find value in. And we're blessed that we're able to still maintain those. Now we got to fight for our position on the shelf, but it's a fun fight, and it's a good fight. It's a fight we believe in and a passion that we have. So we've got the right products in place to help to constantly, you know, win over the consumer. So we're just that the future looks really good. Looks really good.
Well, it certainly sounds like it's in great hands, and that the company will be set to go for many years. And we're thrilled for you with your acquisition of Pacific Rim, which will give you a new dimension to your business activities and all of that. I'm going to ask you to stay on the line. I'm going to wrap this up now for the recording purpose, but I'm going to ask you to stay on the line because I want to get contact information in case I need to go back and get spellings or verify some stuff when I start to write this. So I'll wrap this up and say to our listeners, thank you all. We hope that you have enjoyed this interview, and we'll be doing another one very soon. And then, Christina, I'll be back with you in just 1 second.